Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, the world of insects. We would be in serious trouble without them, as insects are essential to many aspects of life. Entomologist Barrett Klein is a professor of biology at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. That's where you'll find the pupating lab, where he studies insect behavior, sleep biology, and explores the ways in which insects have affected humans throughout history. He's the author of The Insect Epiphany, How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. Welcome, Barrett.
Thank you so much for having me, Mindy.
So your fascination with insects began as a young boy, and like many young boys, searching out bugs was fun and cool, and really became a lifelong fascination for you.
That's right. So E.O. Wilson, a famous ant biologist, would say that everybody goes through an insect phase. He just never grew out of it. And I feel similarly, because I'm a behavioral biologist. So I really love to watch insects. That brings me great comfort and excitement. Yeah. Say there's an ant wandering by, or a bee flying by, or a beetle under a log. What is it up to? And can we better understand their lives and how they relate to our own? So as a five-year-old, having something as accessible in a garden as a grand diversity of insects really thrilled me. Mm-hmm. And so I took advantage of that by bringing them indoors and watching them behave and seeing them reproduce. And that started a lifelong obsession with insects.
Yeah. So many interesting facts in your book. And the first I came across was, insects were the first animals to fly. So what were griffin flies?
Oh my gosh, by hundreds of millions of years. So you look at the Paleozoic and you've got, yes, the griffin flies, Meganeura, Meganeuroptera. They're these dinner plate sized insects. If you think about the spread of their wings, they were massive in large part because the oxygen levels in the atmosphere were much higher then, which sustains their respiratory system, which is basically a series of spiracles or holes on the sides of the body that lead into trachea and tracheoles that can reach, in almost every case, directly to every body cell. So you can't scale up indefinitely or infinitely with that body plan, but back then they could at least be much larger than they are today.
Yeah.
And that goes back, say, several hundred million years. Insects are, there's some evidence of insects being 400 million years old in the fossil record, starting with no wings. But yeah, it took a long time before the three other lineages of vertebrates independently evolved self-powered flight. There were the pterosaurs, there were the birds, and then eventually, the only order of mammals with self-sustained powered flight, the bats.
Yeah, fascinating. So, you know, I think we don't really think about the importance of like all the jobs that insects across the board do. And the one that kind of made me chuckle a little bit was the dung beetle project in Australia, right? So tell us about this. Who would have thought, right? You've got cows that come to Australia and the dung beetles weren't there to clean up.
That's right, exactly. Not that there aren't dung beetles native to Australia. There are a bunch. But if you bring cows with you to a new country, a new continent, where there aren't the beetles or the other insects that have evolved with those mammals to decompose voluminous quantities of moist dung, then you're in trouble. Heaps of trouble. So there was an entrepreneurial entomologist who decided to look at, for Australia, exotic dung beetles that were used to dealing with bovine dung. And bringing them over, trying different species out, this was one way among a whole line and list of decomposers, which include our necessary bacteria and fungi and vertebrates that will take apart carcasses, as well as dung sometimes, the beetles and the flies become omnipotent.
Yeah. I mentioned we'd be in a lot of trouble without insects, and I think people don't really realize. I mean, there's some, like, could we really do without a mosquito? I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's one we can.
Well, so there are roughly, well, there are several thousand described species of mosquitoes on the planet, and some of them do not bite for blood meals that help their developing young. Of the thousands, there are really only a couple hundred that will bother to take a blood meal, and only the females, because this is to help their nourish their young. And among those, there are only a very small subset of species that can serve as vectors of disease. So, yeah, that sounds like a lot of bad news, but if we step back and look at what good mosquitoes serve, I mean, this is from a very anthropocentric or human-centered viewpoint, but without mosquitoes, you'd cripple countless ecosystems because mosquitoes can serve as a valuable food source for not only other invertebrates, those without spinal columns, but fish, birds, reptiles, amphibians, some mammals, bats especially. So if we look at, I spent some time in Austin, Texas, and underneath the Congress Avenue Bridge is the largest urban population of bats. And at sometimes there are 750,000 bats that will zip over the river. They're consuming tons of mosquitoes. So food for others is a really important aspect of mosquito offerings. But interestingly, there are hidden ways, biomimicry. So engineers can look to mosquitoes to better serve humans in terms of delivering a painless syringe and vaccination. So mosquitoes can land on you, and sometimes it can be difficult to sense their approach and even sense their bite. So they're sawing into your flesh, and they have pairs of delicate operating machinery that vibrates at a very specific frequency so that you don't feel them. They produce an anesthetic, an anticoagulant that allows the blood to freely flow. So if we can mimic that, and a couple of labs have attempted to do so, then maybe you can deliver a vaccination with less pain or no pain.
See, they all everything has a role, right? Everything has a purpose. And just about the bats in Austin, I've seen that. That is, if you're anybody's in Austin, you have got to go to the bridge and see that. That is unbelievable. Hundreds and thousands of them. Yeah,
That's
crazy.
right. Like, I mean, like insects and some arachnids, people tend to be repelled by until they get to know them better. And with the bats, people tend to be scared and think of rabies until you produce, say, better PR for these organisms, as they've done in Austin.
Right.
And now that's a tourist attraction.
Yeah, brings plenty of money into Austin, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the products that are produced by insects, and you cover a number of them in the book. And I think one that many are familiar with is is silk, right? The silkworm. And so, but I always thought, okay, silkworm. I think we knew that, but the silkworm is not the only silk spinning insect. Who knew?
Oh, that's right. So if you look at Lepidoptera, which literally means scaly wing, these are the moths and the butterflies. There are over 180,000 described species, and each and every one of those will spin silk from head-based glands as larvae, as caterpillars. And they do so in order to protect themselves as they pupate or go from a larva to an adult in that really static, sessile form, usually dangling from a branch or in leaf litter if you're a moth, for example. That silk is really valuable to the insect because it's a super strong, flexible fiber. And in the case of the silkworm moth, this is just one species domesticated moth, Bombyx mori. For several thousand years, we've been breeding them to such an extent that they're wholly reliant on Homo sapiens. They can't fly without us. So they couldn't even find each other to mate. They also have reduced chemical perception. save for a sexual pheromone, they're pretty lacking in their ability to smell. So they're really tied to humans. But yeah, there are so many others that spin silk, even beyond that order of moths and butterflies, Lepidoptera. You can think to a whole host of other orders of insects and arachnids, think spiders.
Right. I was going to say that the spider silk, and you write, black widows and other spider species were collected and kept in U.S. spider ranches, and their silk reeled and used to create crosshairs for
Yeah.
gun sights and range finders during World War II. Another fact that I think a lot of people didn't know about. I never even heard of, I mean, who would think to use spider silk, but it's pretty strong. What do we use it
Yeah,
for? Yeah,
here
what do
we're
we use it
looking
for
at black
now?
widow
Yeah.
spiders and other spiders. That's right. And this is because nothing up to that point, even through World War II and beyond, was as strong, as consistent, as stable. So using them for eyesights, for optical devices, military and otherwise, was really important.
Do we use it now for anything? I mean, do they use spider silk now?
Well, in Madagascar, there were a pair of designers who teamed up with local residents in Madagascar to collect silk from 1 million Nephila spiders. They let them go afterwards. So they just collected the silk from the live spinning spiders in order to produce garments,
Wow.
lustrous yellow garments. So this is, I mean, a couple of hundred years ago, there are records that entrepreneurial spider harvesters or silk harvesters from spiders would produce stockings or gloves and other components for royalty. None of these survive. So thinking about, can a spider produce enough silk that we could use this very strong, shimmering fiber for fabrics in competition with silkworm moths. Well, a French entrepreneur tried to assess this and said, nope, won't work. But a connection to Rumor later was that he was forward-thinking enough to look at both North American and European paper wasps to say, hey, maybe we should rely less on these unsustainable rags for paper and use wood as they do instead. So they're all manner of products. In this case, say, masticating or chewing up wood from a fallen tree or a fence post, combining it with saliva to form a durable, water-resistant paper nest that we could use for our own paper. So people have done that. Artists have done that. Biomimetics engineers have done that. And now, of course, following well after the Chinese independently derived wood for paper, we do that.
Yeah, amazing the stuff we can learn from insects. We're talking with Barrett Klein. His book is The Insect Epiphany: How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking insects this morning with entomologist Barrett Klein. He's a professor of biology at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. He's the author of The Insect Epiphany: How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. I think honey and beeswax, people think, you know, that's one most people know about. And beeswax never goes bad, right? Beekeeping, though, goes a lot farther back in history than some may imagine.
Yeah, we could zip back several thousand years to think about the origins of honey robbing. So I mentioned a most recent discovery of a cave painting of a robbery in Spain. So there are such paintings in caves in Africa. In fact, most are in Africa, in one small region of India, and then on the Iberian Peninsula, like Spain. And this most recent discovery showed quite a sophisticated rope lashing mechanism by which a human could scale a sheer cliff face and then access one of these cliff face dwelling honeybee colonies in order to access the not only the beeswax and the honey, but say the developing brood, the grubs inside, all of which can serve utilitarian purposes. The grubs are a highly proteinaceous, nutritious food source. The honey, amped up carbohydrates for energy. Some anthropologists and archaeologists have suggested that really shaped Homo sapiens in terms of offering us that extra sustenance that allowed us to expand our brains, plus thinking in very clever ways about building the tools simply to access these nests. And the beeswax used for adhesive, for structural purposes, and since then for countless uses from encaustics in art, cosmetics, adhesives again, and substrates for all manner of utilitarian purposes. So the Spanish scene, imagine a painter depicting this robbery where you have someone who's not protected at all from these thousands of stinging bees to lob off and bring down this valuable resource. This is a robbery. And then millennia later, you've got, and even today, people will use logs, hollow logs, and hang them in order for swarms of bees to insert themselves and rob them. So it's a one-time stealing for accessing those substrates. Until someone said, hey, maybe we could make frames within which they build the beeswax honeycomb. So now we can have these perennial colonies running. And so this offered us a more, you might say, mutually beneficial relationship with the bees. And so this resulted in apiculture. And apiculture has existed for several thousand years. You see evidence in Egypt. You see evidence in Israel. So in Tel Rehov in Israel, there is an archaeological site with the oldest evidence of the actual bee hives. And hives are different than nests. Hives are the human-made architecture within which bees build their nests. So here you've got evidence not only of the hives, but of the burnt-up bee bodies themselves. So Guy Bloch in Israel studied the bees to understand who they were. So it's fascinating.
Another little fascinating tidbit in the book, you write, archaeologists faced with limited means of estimating cave paintings age has discovered ways to use wasps' nests as a guide. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. So you'll see mud dauber wasp nests on buildings. And people scrape them off and they're really annoyed by them. I love them. So you've got these wasps, and they're called mud daubers because they'll fly off to moist soil. Say, if you're watering your garden, they'll collect that soil and then they'll build their nest based on that combined with saliva. Well, some of those structures are so durable that they'll last for years, even for centuries. Even for thousands of years. So, this can be an annoyance for curators of art or for architects or people who maintain buildings. But sometimes they hold great benefits. And in the case of aging these paintings, you can at least have some degree of earliest versus latest. This could have possibly been painted by looking at whether or not the wasp nest is on top of the paint versus the paint is on top of the wasp nest. So that can help date, as well as doing an analysis of the components of that wasp nest itself and comparing it to the breakdown of the components of local soils. So this has been very helpful for archaeologists.
Yeah,
Oh, and I
fascinating.
should mention the wax, one of the greatest use of beeswax has been for the lost wax process. So if you look at all these pre-Columbian gold sculptures, as well as African metal sculptures, as well as European sculptures in museums, many of those are derived from wax sculptures that were melted out from their investitures and replaced with molten metal.
The other thing I thought was really interesting I'd never heard of is that greater honey guide bird. This is people actually follow this bird to find the honey, right?
That's right. And beautifully, their species name is Indicator Indicator. Yep, they're indicating where you can find and rob the honeybee nests that are naturally occurring in the cavities of trees. So, say you're in a part of Africa where you have this cultural tradition of calling out, and they have specific ways to call out to these birds. And this indicator, indicator, greater honey guide, has learned to associate this communication by a different species, a primate, Homo sapiens, and they'll call back. And so, what the humans will do, will follow these birds step by step. The bird will fly from this tree to that tree and land on a branch and wait patiently for the humans to follow suit. And then again and again, all the way to the cavity that happens to be housing a honeybee colony. Well, then it doesn't end there because the human will typically scale the tree. And this is a really fascinating process by which they do this. And sometimes they'll cut down the tree or cut down part of that tree or access the nest from that cavity. And what they do in turn, reciprocity, they'll leave a chunk of honeycomb filled with honey for that bird. And
Teamwork.
so you can
Yeah.
bet, yeah, exactly. You can bet that the next time they call out for the bird to guide them, the bird will then remember, indicator, indicator, will remember that
Yeah.
and reciprocate.
That's funny. Jean Marie writes, I've often wondered, and please ask your guests, what is or are the redeeming value of ticks? Are they an essential food force for some animals? Good question.
Yeah, so redeeming value. What are the redeeming values of humans? Of, and the list could go on, right? So we can think from the tick standpoint, wow, we have great value. Now, from a human standpoint, I'm going to think, okay, what are the, and we can call them ecosystem services, or we could think about cultural services of ticks. And you're right, this is a little bit more difficult from a human standpoint to think about a value. And you're also right to predict that, yes, indeed, they serve as food for a variety of other organisms. So if you think about chickens in the backyard or in a farm, boo, 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 what are they going for? Wow, you can bet you'll probably have a tick-free environment in that local vicinity because they snap them up because of the high levels of protein and nutrients. Now, ticks can serve as food for a variety of non-birds as well. Now, if I jump over to cultural services, ticks have appeared in music and art and all kinds of literature. So you could delve into the variety of human products that have been derived from or inspired by this group of, this order of arachnids. So they're not insects. Insects are, well, let's back up. Arthropods, the most species-rich group of animals, a phylum of animals, Arthropoda or arthropods are jointed, segmented, legged organisms with chitinous, hard exoskeletons. And if you have six of these segmented jointed legs, then you're hexapods. And most of those are insects. They have a pair of antennae, and they have a special organ called the Johnston's organ in their antennae, and they often have wings. Well, arachnids, like spiders, like ticks and mites and scorpions and others, they'll have those same segmented jointed legs, but they'll have eight locomotory limbs, four pairs rather than three pairs. No antennae, no wings, and other special mouth parts called chelicerae.
All right. I want to talk about cicadas. You talk about cicadas. I didn't realize thousands of species, right? But nine of which are periodical. And we have one such species here on Cape Cod that emerges every 17 years. 2025 coming up is when we
Bum,
expect
bum,
to see them
bum.
again. These are fascinating
Fabulous.
creatures, and if you listen to the sound they make, it sounds like the background from every 1950s scary movie, right?
So that, n-n-n-n-n. Actually, in the Dong people in China will have a tradition in which women will produce a chorus that mimics chorusing male cicadas. So it's a n-n-n-n-n-n-n. It's beautiful. And you're correct. So the nine species of periodical cicadas, seven of them are in the eastern United States. So there's one in Fiji, and there's one in India. But we have these, what are periodical cicadas? They're cicadas that live for protracted periods of time in the earth, in the soil, as nymphs that are developing by feeding on the xylem liquids that flow through the roots, typically of trees. And then they'll rise, in the case of periodical cicadas, en masse. And in the most extreme cases, after 13 years or 17 years, and I was able to witness, and this only happens once in every 245 years or so, the overlap of two broods at one time. It was in the Springfield, Illinois area, where the trees were full of the cacophony of male cicadas calling out by vibrating their timbals and an echo chamber from their bodies to females to
Yeah.
mate.
I can't wait to see them again. They're the coolest looking creatures, right?
Yeah, and you have some musicians will go out and play with them and record with them. Some artists will be inspired to include cicadas in their artwork. And my friend Joseph Yun of Brooklyn Bugs and others will collect them for culinary reasons.
Right.
So there are traditions, Native American and indigenous traditions, of consuming these periodical cicadas. And now modern new traditions, collecting them for haute cuisine.
Amy, you want to play that now? I think Amy found some cicada sound for us, a sonic. Okay, let's listen to it.
The thing about the sound of them is, though, they come in waves.
Summer visitor Matthew Carmichael on the 2008 arrival of the cicadas in Mashpee.
You try to, like, get rid of it and consider it white noise, but when you think you finally are in tune with it, it just goes a different wavelength, so it just reappears in your head.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
There's that sound. We'll be hearing it again soon. You write about the chef who collects these periodical cicadas for experimentation in recipes. I don't know that I would think much about eating them, to tell you the truth, but people do,
Well,
right?
people draw their lines. It's a very, as Joseph Yun himself will say, it's a very personal, maybe the most personal choice we make, what we place inside our body, what we consume, what we imbibe. And so where we draw our lines, are we vegans? Are we vegetarians? Will we consume some animal meat? What will that meat consist of? Does it include shrimp or lobster? Well, insects are one lineage within crustaceans. So then it becomes somewhat of an arbitrary choice. If your ethics or your spiritual beliefs or your alert allergies aren't guiding you as to what you consume.
Yeah. And there are plenty of insects that are used for food around the world, right?
Yeah. In one recent paper estimated a very conservative estimate of 1,611 species of insects consumed around the world for traditional purposes, but the number is actually much higher, well over 2,000 species. If you look to Oaxaca, Mexico, I believe 156 species have traditionally been eaten there alone. And there are good reasons, mm-hmm. because in terms of sustainability, it's really unsustainable to eat cows and pigs and even chickens, far more sustainable in by a lot of measures in terms of how much of the organism is used, how much waste is produced, how much water goes into, and the list goes on, how much land use is mm-hmm. invested in. So insects would be the next up, and then non-animal consumption, say as yeah. a vegetarian or a vegan.
All right. I know you've tasted many different types of insects. Are some, I mean, you think of like the chocolate covered whatever, but I mean, are there some that have a flavor that you like? I mean, what would that be?
Oh, absolutely. Just as, I mean, if you do eat, well, vegetables or fruits, I think you could ask, can fruits be tasty and do they differ in their taste? You bet they can and do. Yeah. Similarly, insects are composed of varying proportions of lipids, carbohydrates, proteins, and the makeup is different insect to insect. Some will have chemical defenses, and just as we'll eat onions and mustard and peppers mm-hmm. that are actually warning some vertebrates not to eat them, well, now we consider them spicy and delicious, right? Similarly, humans have incorporated traditionally insects in their diets because of their spiciness.
Yeah.
So I can point out one insect in particular. There's a kind of lemon ant, and it's this tiny black ant. And yes, you can cover insects in chocolate. You can cover anything in chocolate, mm-hmm. and it'll taste pretty good, right? Because yeah. chocolate tastes great. By the
right.
way, chocolate only exists because of pollinating insects, and there are potentially thousands of different species that pollinate cacao. Well, the lemon ant is a serious, like, lemon citrus bite to it.
Hmm.
So that's very different than, say, a cerambycid longhorn beetle larva, mm-hmm. or, and many people will eat, silkworm moth pupae,
mm.
or, and the list goes on.
Yeah.
Stink bugs.
Yeah, I think I'm going to pass on that one. But, you know, do you have a story in the book? And was it a katydid? What was it? You were eating something. Was it a katydid that flew in and kind of regurgitated on your food? And you went, well, let me see what this tastes like.
Yeah, one of many. So there I was in Panama, and I was making a pasta dish after a field day of research looking at insect behavior. And it was a really boring meal. I didn't have any real sauce to put on it. And in the window, a giant katydid flew in and just happened to land on my plate. And so as I attempted to delicately grab her so I could free her, she did what a number of grasshoppers and some katydids do, regurgitate a meal that they had consumed earlier. What they'll do is they'll eat plants, and many plants have their own chemical defenses, including a class of chemicals called alkaloids that can be very bitter tasting. And they'll store them in a crop and then regurgitate them if they're threatened. So it's a defense. Who wants to eat that bitter? And so the katydid reflexively regurgitated this brown liquid on my pasta. And so I decided to exploit this invitation. And I squeezed the katydid and mixed her around my pasta dish and then let her fly out the window. And then I mixed it up. And sure enough, that pasta dish was far more appetizing. Sometimes Now, I don't recommend everyone on Cape Cod run out and grab an insect and
No.
consume it or consume what it regurgitates, because there's a reason why they regurgitate. And I've had some negative experience,
Oh,
culinary
okay.
experiences. But if you choose the right insects or you prepare them in a proper way, then as we've mentioned, there are a whole host of
Well.
insects that have been traditionally consumed by
And
people.
another interesting note that if you are allergic to eating seafood, you may also be allergic to insects. Because they're what, closely
Well,
related to crabs and shrimp and other
that's right.
shellfish, right?
So insects, hexapods, sister group is this blind centipede-like remipede at the bottom of some oceans, and that's within the larger tree of crustaceans. And crustaceans are arthropods, so they have this chitinous exoskeleton. Chitin is the second most common biopolymer on planet Earth, only second to cellulose in plant cell walls. So it's really common, and it's common because it's effective. It's a very strong laminar arrangement that protects them with their exoskeletons. So if you happen to be allergic to components within that exoskeleton, in, say, for example, a shrimp, you may be more likely to be allergic to the exoskeleton of a cricket.
Well, good to know. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the world of insects this morning with entomologist Barrett Klein. He's a professor of biology at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. Also the author of The Insect Epiphany, How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We got a question from a listener that like ties in. I was going to mention insects as medical benefits, and we got this
Yes.
question that it was a listener who may be reading my mind here. What do you think about bee venom being used for medicine?
So apitherapy, the use of honeybee venom, has a long history, and it's actually been effective in many studies across a number of different ailments. So, for example, arthritis, arthralgia, Parkinson's syndrome, even for lower back pain, ALS. So a variety of different medical predicaments have benefited from, probably due to increased circulation, but people aren't actually sure. This is an example where a lot more controlled experimentation can reveal how the venom actually benefits. But bee venom isn't the only venom that has been used for medical research. There are scorpion venoms, there are spider venoms, there are toxins within a caterpillar and cantharid beetles that have anti-cancer agents. So there's a lot of potential within the bodies of insects and arachnids to combat cancers and other human diseases.
I want you to tell the story of the click beetle in the rainforest of Costa Rica. We think of lightning bugs, right? But you had an interesting experience where the click
Oh
beetle
yeah.
basically saved you.
Yeah, that's right. So one of my favorite entomologists, Dave Wagner, came up to me when I was just on the edge of the forest in Costa Rica, La Selva, Costa Rica, and he said, "Hey Barrett, just take a flashlight, and all you have to do is do this motion and quickly put your hand over it. And that will signal to a species of click beetle to fly in, just like fireflies, a different family of beetle. Click beetles are Elateridae. You have them on Cape Cod. And Lampyridae, the fireflies or lightning beetles, you also have on Cape Cod. Both bioluminesce, produce a virtually heatless light from their bodies. Well, in the case of the click beetle, they can be pretty hefty. And I thought, oh, come on, this is ridiculous. And so I took my headlamp and I tried it after he left. He had to run. And I tried it once, and then shoo, thunk, right into my chest, flew one of these large click beetles. I thought, wow, this is amazing. You've got, they're called headlight beetles because they have a pair of these bioluminescing organs on the back of their prothorax, the first part of the midsection of their body. And so I thought, wow, I'm going to put this in a little jar, a vial, and at the end of the night, I'll show it to my colleagues and friends before I let the beetle go. And so put the beetle in my pocket, and I decided, well, you know what? I'm going to go off into the forest and just take a hike alone. And as I went off, it became pretty dark pretty fast, and I collected data from hitchhikers on leafcutter ants, and this was a study I was conducting. And by this time, the light was dropping fast, which meant to a scientist, I had to collect data faster. But then my headlight was gone. I had no other source of light. How was I going to get back? There are fair-to-lance snakes and army ants and other dangers in the darkness. So I thought, okay, well, I could just stand here all night, or I could try to shuffle dangerously my way either on or off a trail. Or, bing, 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 I remembered the click beetle in my pocket. So I pulled out the vial and held the bioluminescing click beetle close to the trail and just slowly made my way back to our camp.
Amazing. Yeah. Right, I got a spoiler alert here. In the section on art, you have two pages of photos of some pretty famous artwork, right? And you ask the question, which works of art include insects or insect bodily products? I bet it's all of them. It is. It's all of them.
Answer, no. So I'm not going to give a spoiler. There are some that are not, because I didn't want that to be the easy answer. Oh, it must be all of them, right?
That's what
or
I thought.
None of them. But no.
Okay, I didn't read every single one, but a lot of them I look at my, yes.
Yeah. The fun part is, and that was actually my favorite figure to put together in the whole book, because I wanted it to be a quiz. Yeah. I wanted participation and for readers to really think, like, okay, so that's obviously insect themed. You see an insect, Albrecht Dürer's stag beetle, this famous image, obviously insect themed. And then maybe this other one you could imagine probably involves beeswax in some way. But a host of them hint at the clandestine or hidden ways that insects have affected artworks throughout our history. Yeah. So insects have been here far longer than humans. We share a common ancestor with chimpanzees 6 to 7 million years old, and insects have been around well over 400 million years old, right? So as soon as we hit the scene, we've been surrounded by insects, and for medical gain, for sustenance, and then eventually artistically, with evidence that's about, say, 16 to 20,000 years old in the form of a cricket inscribed in a bison bone, we've been inspired by insects. So I wanted to feed into this with, like, could that include an insect?
Yeah,
and sure enough, much of the world of art may be coated, for example, with insect exudates.
And not only, I mean, also insects inspire robots. We learn from, like, medical, art. I mean, they really touch really all aspects of our lives, don't they?
Yes. And robots, we could talk about all manner of robots. I'll pick on micro aerial robots, because drones are big in the news today. Drones, some of them are named after insects. And some of the earliest drones were based on insect flight in some way. We could even go back to Leonardo da Vinci. His most complicated flying machine was fashioned after a dragonfly. So this brings me to 1970s, where the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency in the US, decided we need a tiny spy, a fly on the wall. So in order for espionage to take advantage of this idea of the fly on the wall, we need to make a robot bumblebee. Well, that kind of failed because bumblebees fly so erratically. And there was an amateur dragonfly aficionado on the team. So he said, "How about Anax junius, the green darner, this very large dragonfly?" And so they built a robot, and this robot, yes, was successful in flying for 60 seconds and 200 meters, but guiding it with a laser just wasn't working because the slightest crosswind would shoot it off course. Now, this didn't prevent the KGB in Russia from apparently building, then the Soviet Union, from building their own dragonfly robot spy.
Yeah. Now, you write, a recurring revelation while writing this book emerges. Insects perform as the unseen actors behind much of what we do and who we are. And you go on to talk about some of that and says, by almost every measure, insects play an outsized role in shaping our existence. So, what happens when our actions lead to their decline?
That's right. I mean, we can think of them as symbols affecting how we dress, what we eat, where we travel, what jobs and avocations we take on. And that's just the cultural component. We haven't even addressed a host of important ecosystem services from pollination, we mentioned decomposition, soil aeration, nutrient dispersal. Food for others, we did talk about, but also bioindicators. Are this freshwater healthy, for example? So, for all those reasons and more, if we imagine the quintillions of insects and the grand diversity, over a million described, vanishing from the planet, where would we be? We might have a few extra moments in time to witness the crumbling of ecosystems before we suffer the consequences of their absence.
So we need to be mindful of that. So, in the last minute and a half or so that we have, what gives you optimism?
Several things give me optimism. I think today, more so than any time in Homo sapiens history, we have a better understanding of natural phenomena and how the world operates. Also, we're interconnected in a way across the planet as we've never been before. If we harness our knowledge of how ecosystems operate and how our allies, the insects, contribute to ecosystem function, we can pave a path by embracing our neighbors rather than destroying our neighbors. What else gives me optimism? When I go into a classroom, it can be an elementary school, it can be a junior high, a high school, it can be the university students I teach. And when I see their eyes light up, it feels like electricity when they get excited about the stories related to insects. When I find, as I mentioned in my book, just a small patch of earth, and I look for the array of behaviors, the diversity of arthropods, their architecture, their defenses, all the interactions, the chemical communication, that inspires me.
The book is The Insect Epiphany: How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Barrett Klein, thanks so much for being with us. What a fun hour that was. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Mindy. It's been a great pleasure.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.